You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au. Bring who you are as you enter our church this morning. Bring your best self and your struggling self. Bring your mistakes and your triumphs. Bring your shortcomings and your recommitment to good. Bring yourself here and open your heart to beauty, to truth, to the door that is open to the presence of the good. Here in this church, we are trying to walk together on the peaceable way, trying to hammer out division and hatred and all that separates one from another. We try, and we will fall short, but held in love, we try again. We come together this morning as a church to bow our heads in prayerful reflection and to raise our voices in song, and to remember our promises and vow to live by them once again. Well, good morning and welcome to our service of worship. It is a service because it means to serve you, and it is worship because it means to serve you by raising to worth things that matter. My name is Rob McPherson, the minister of this church, and I welcome you here on behalf of generations of Unitarians who have worshipped in similar gatherings in South Australia since 1854. We are a spiritual community that encourages and supports all who come to find, to fashion, and most importantly, to follow their own spiritual path. Any path that helps you see more clearly, love more abundantly, and work toward a better world for all. You're invited to kick on with us after today's service for coffee, tea, and conversation. Let's join together in singing our opening hymn, Come and Find the Quiet Center. Please stand as you're able. I'm going to stick my neck out today and make what I feel is an unambiguous truth claim. Contemporary civilization is becoming increasingly uncivil. The cultivation and practice of civility is no longer valued as a hallmark of moral living, and has been gradually replaced by its opposite, incivility. We're increasingly steeped in a popular discourse characterized by the verbal smackdown, the gotcha, and what they call the sick burn. It's easy to blame the emergence of anonymous online communication for this, but I actually think it's a little older than internet trolls, which, if you don't know, are frustrated souls who apparently get a buzz starting fights online, upsetting people, then claiming, "Free speech, man," and then decrying political correctness gone mad. Actual research indicates an older pedigree for this incivility, beginning with the exponential increase of TV and film script writing as mainstays of popular culture. They say if Shakespeare were alive today, that's the medium he'd be writing for. Like the Elizabethan theater, TV and film writing is competitive, popular, high stakes, and well paid. Since the advent of cable TV in the 80s and now, streaming proliferation of fictional and fictionalized stories steeped in smart, snappy, well-written dialogue, we've gotten used to the buzz of hearing just the perfectly wounding comeback in conflict situations, the sort of things that it would not have occurred to people in real life till well after the event. Sharp-witted screenwriters make big money by getting their characters to say the things you wish you could have said under similar circumstances. Of course, screenwriters have all day to sit around together in comfort and bounce one-liners off of each other, and then put the best lines in the mouth of the actor. This, by the way, is why actors always seem sharper witted than most of them in fact are. I speak this in knowing. Most folks don't have a professional scriptwriter in their heads writing their dialogue, and in tense, conflicted situations, we generally splutter and flounder and think much later what should have been said to put so-and-so in their place. So we love the scripted performance of the perfect burn. The French have a name for the perfect comeback that comes to you too late in real life. Of course, the French have a word for it. They call it l'esprit d'escalier, which means the spirit of the staircase. So imagine you're a couple living in a flat and you have a fight. And one of you gets to a point where words fail you, and rather than offer emotional violence, you rage out the door and down the stairwell. And then, at the bottom of the stairs, it hits you. What you ought to have said, the perfect sick burn that would have won the altercation, but now it's too late. You've abandoned the field. Quel dommage! Since we swim in a sea of fictionalized conflict, without which there can be no TV or film drama without conflict, we are acclimatized to conflict and the snappy dialogue it requires. Alas, this cultural discourse does not model civility well. But then again, nor does capitalism, founded on dog-eat-dog conflict. But that's another talk. There's some solid science why our better thinking gets hijacked, gets blocked in conflict situations, and only comes back to us when we've had a little while to come back to our senses. In performance studies, we call it the amygdala hijack. The amygdala is a part of the brainstem we share with reptiles that governs our fight or flight response. And the amygdala in a conflict perceives a threat, and it takes over your response. Adrenaline pumps, the breathing gets shallow, the brain is starved of oxygen, so thinking is occluded. So imagine walking down that flight of stairs after the argument. Not only is it a pause and a change of scene for the brain to reset, but walking down the stairs also regulates and deepens the breathing. So you get more oxygen, and then your thinking clears, and boom, the right words come. This is also why 90% of acting is learning to relax during imagined conflict, because without a conflict, there'd be no drama. Given our ancient animal instincts for self-preservation, how do we normal souls stay cool in the conflicts that inevitably form part of the warp and weft of real life? Where may we find models of dignity, lucidity, civility in our increasingly uncivil age? Well, maybe we could look to our civic leaders as models of civility. I'm going to go out on a limb again and venture that our political leaders don't really role model civil discourse well in the cut and thrust of parliamentary yaboo sucks banter of that most debased form of discourse. I'm talking about debate. In debate, winning is the one and only aim, winning at any cost to logic, factuality, compassion, and certainly the old-fashioned qualities of restraint, self-possession, and decorum. By the way, I know how old-fartish this sounds, but at 61 I am one now, so that's how it comes out. The thing about incivility is hard to see when you're doing it. It's far easier to perceive when it's being done to you or yours. You may have noted recently that Lord Alexander of Downer decried the uncivil state of political discourse when some was directed at his daughter via social media, who had to lower herself to actually getting elected by the commoners of Mayo in the seat that is the Downer family's hereditary entitlement by divine right of kings, apparently. Yet his lordship was silent when his own mob let rip an exponentially more sustained and devastating tsunami of vitriol in the national media on then PM Julia Gillard. Some of the most graceless sexist bile yet vented from the spleen of frustrated power. I am not, by the way, suggesting that incivility is a matter of gender. Girls and boys both come out to play. I don't know, Downer seems like a pretty sharp guy. Maybe he just wasn't paying attention then. I bet he is now. Sauce for the goose, my Alex Gander. But I doubt he will be raising the tone of public discourse after this, do you? And this is the problem. Bile begets bile. Incivility begets itself. How to avoid this vicious cycle? Role modeling civility, even in the high stakes heat of political conflict, doesn't seem to do any good, even if you have good role models. Here's a very civil man who attracted a great deal of incivility, like this. Yet he did not ever respond in kind. Imagine that. It seems like ages ago, doesn't it, that anyone in public life tried to lift us above anything other than bile and the sick comeback burn. Listen to these words.
Let's acknowledge that democracy has always been messy. Divisions are hardly new in this country, and I'm profoundly mindful that a loyal opposition, a vigorous back and forth, a skepticism of power, all of that is what makes our democracy work. But there is a sense that something is different now, that something is broken, that we are not serving the people as well as we should. At times, it seems like we are unable to listen to one another, to have at once a serious and civil debate. And this erosion of civility in the public square sows division and distrust among our citizens. It poisons the well of public opinion. It leaves each side little room to negotiate with the other. It makes politics an all-or-nothing sport, where one side is either always right or always wrong, when in reality, neither side has a monopoly on truth. And then we lose sight of the children without food and the men without shelter and the families without health care. Empowered by faith, consistently, prayerfully, we need to find our way back to civility. That begins with stepping out of our comfort zones in an effort to bridge divisions, stretching out of our dogmas, our prescribed roles along the political spectrum that can help us regain a sense of civility. Civility also requires relearning how to disagree without being disagreeable. Understanding, as President Kennedy said, that civility is not a sign of weakness.
Thanks, Minnie. Refreshingly civil for political discourse, wasn't it? Note the quasi-religious language Obama used to invoke the moral dimension of civil discourse. Yeah? Not bad for a communist, fascist, jihadist, eh? I forgot atheist. That's in there. Incivility is more than just bad manners or poor social skills. What makes civility morally significant is that history has shown that the dehumanization of people begins with dehumanizing language. And when we engage others without civility, we are disrespecting them as equals. For after all, we expect respect and civility for ourselves, don't we? And worse, we coarsen our sensibilities, making it that much harder to see, as the Quakers say, that of God in everyone, or as our first principle puts it, the inherent worth and dignity of every person. And without that basis of our first principle, you can't really have the second, can you? The Judaic tradition that informs Unitarian history has much to say about the importance of civility. The laws, called Lashon Hara, provide guidance in right speech. Rabbis compare the act of shaming someone to the shedding of blood, because the blood drains from the face of the person shamed. Perhaps they also recognize that shaming someone can often cause long-term or permanent damage to the psyche, reputation, or livelihood of the person. When Rabbi Hillel was asked by a smart-ass skeptic to teach the entire Torah in one go, he answered, "What is hateful to you, do not do to your fellow." That's the whole Torah. The rest is commentary. Go study. Saying anything derogatory about another person is absolutely forbidden by Jewish law, except in very limited circumstances. Even if the statement is true, it's forbidden to be derogatory. If a statement is false, even only in some minor way, it is considered motzi shem hara, defamation of character, an even worse offense. And it's no defense to say that the statement is true. It's also no defense to say it was made in jest, because it's just a joke, or that everybody knew it anyway, or that the speaker included him or herself in the derogatory remark. So all this is to suggest that clearly taking the trouble to speak decently to your fellow human beings was an important and crucial teaching of Jewish tradition. However, there are times when it's necessary to point out to someone else that he or she has in fact erred. The Talmud, citing Leviticus, states that one has an obligation to rebuke another when necessary, and even to do so more than once if the other persists in error. However, one is not permitted to shame the person to the point where he or she turns white. This is clearly a matter of mindful restraint. It's helpful to remember that any rebuke is supposed to help the other person bring his or her ways into the spirit of the law. It's not supposed to be a vent for the rebuker's rage or hatred. The Jewish tradition to teach through admonishment in this way is echoed in the early letters of Paul to the early churches. This is one of those messages. Teach and admonish one another. Remember, these early churches were made up of Jews, Greeks, and Gentiles, tribal factions that did not exactly get along all the time. Now, before you go thinking that such nuanced cautions about the effects of our speech are the exclusive preserve of one tradition, the Buddhist practice of the metta prayer encourages us to build compassion for others upon the compassion we have for ourselves. It is set to music as our second hymn. May I be filled with loving kindness. Please stand as you're able. You see how that works? You begin with compassion for yourself. Please be seated. You go through compassion to the person you're addressing and compassion for all the world. Easy to build on the tradition of basis of self-love. It's not enough, though. It's not enough to say that most religious tradition counsels against shaming and the sick burns typical of the incivility of modern discourse, or that it's not in keeping with our first and second principles. We must acknowledge that at the root of these is something all too human, the amygdala, the part of the brain shared with reptiles. It is a persistent force in our lives and must be actively reckoned with. Human evolution has added layers to the brain that have made abstract, reasoned thinking and thus civilization possible. Most of religious practice is a call to evolve our awareness more into that part of the mind where we can exercise control over our baser instincts and thus be freed of being a slave to them. You remember that kingdom of heaven Jesus talked about? It's not a heavenly pie in the sky one, but a heavenly earth that's possible when we treat each other, all others, even those who get our goat, with the kind of kindness and compassion we have for ourselves. The freedom to be uncivil, the freedom to troll, the freedom to burn, the freedom to smack down, these all feel like freedom, but they aren't. They are enslavement to the reptile in us. And our culture shows that it is easy to prod that beast into bitchy responses. And so it's becoming harder to exercise the restraint of a measured response to conflict that is not at least unkind. We aspire to be a church of free souls, not enslaved. But liberty does not mean license. Doing and saying whatever the hell you feel like, whatever your feelings in the moment prompt you to, that is anarchy under which no one really feels free. Real freedom is the freedom to actually choose your responses wisely, the freedom to shape our discourse toward others as we would be willing to receive it. This freedom to put cool thought first and the heat of emotion second is not easy. It's not easy. It's hard. It takes calm and courage, and it works against eons of evolution. But it calls us to evolve into our higher, newer, evolved minds. And if it were easy, everybody'd be doing it, and what would become of our moral superiority? Or that better way of being that this little microcosm of the world called a church envisions and hopes to model. Bet you'd forgotten all about that. We're supposed to model this decency, this civility. And it's easy in moment to moment. It's in these moment to moment free choices, courageous choices of restraint, that mindful right speech can be made. It's in these moment to moment choices that civility can be cultivated. Popular culture seldom gives us models of the old-fashioned virtues of dignity, lucidity, restraint, decorum, of good civic character. But maybe it's not so old-fashioned as we old farts might like to think. Maybe it's not the exclusive preserve of bygone generations back in ye olde days when things were better. Maybe it's coming back into fashion. Have a look at someone in conflict who has every reason to have her amygdala hijack her responses. I'm going to show you a little film clip in a moment, but in not giving in to that, and not giving in to the amygdala hijack, she achieves true freedom and a far greater civil good. Little background. This is Ellen Ersson, a Swedish student. Sweden, like much of the EU, has recently lurched to the right on immigration reform and is deporting people back to war zones like Afghanistan, regardless of the consequences for the people deported. Ellen found herself on a flight with one Afghani who was being so deported from Sweden. Watch this video, focusing not so much on what she's doing, but how she's doing it, how she's conducting herself. She's holding up an airline schedule to preserve a life. That's the fundamental crux of it. Thousands will be affected around the world, and she knows it. Even with all that systemic and peer group pressure on the plane, with bigger, stronger passengers getting in her face, taking her phone, shouting at her, she doesn't return the abuse. She barely raises her voice. She tells them what she's doing and why she's doing it. She leaves it up to the pilot to decide it's his plane, what he wants to do. She persists. She persists in doing the civil thing, which is an act of civil disobedience, part of our Unitarian tradition, done in a civil manner. So it's an act of civil disobedience done with civility. Even in obvious quaking fear and moral outrage, she doesn't use her own emotional state as an excuse for losing her civility. No lashon hara from her, no evil tongue, just loving kindness for the truly oppressed and needful admonishment of those whose busy lives would otherwise have just let it happen and got on with their day. Now you could point out that they will just put the man on another flight to his death, and they did. Or that people who had no awareness of the human rights issue downstream would have missed connections, which they did. I bet they have an awareness of the human rights issue now. Further, you could, if you wanted to, impute self-seeking motives to her. You could call this virtue signaling. You could say it meant nothing but 15 minutes of internet fame for her. You could look on it as a performance in a heavily mediatized age that she's in fact just acting a kind of character. If so, she just passed the first year of acting school because she's learned to keep her cool in dramatic conflict. Why would you offer such interpretations unless her brave civility drains the blood from your face and you feel shame for the times you too could have stood calmly in your truth and done something for someone who needed it, and you didn't? I know that's how I felt. If Shakespeare were writing this episode up as one of his dramatic scripts, he would no doubt have ratcheted up the stakes of the conflict, and at the height of the tension, he would have put in Elin's mouth a grand soliloquy barbed with stinging things we wish we'd have said once we'd ascended the staircase and got our better thinking back. And we'd thrill to it and applaud the burn she would lay on all the supporting characters. But conflict can spark the amygdala and blur the wits, and we non-actors splutter and second guess, while incivility and worse, dehumanization flourishes around us. What can a simple real-life soul like you and me do to build a better world? Taking a cue from Aelin, you too can take a deep breath, find your quiet center, and act from your values with kindness and firmness. And that, too, is an old-fashioned virtue we old farts called character. Character. Character is not the exclusive preserve of the old and jaded, nor of the young and idealistic. Doing the civil thing is, as it has always been, a choice it is possible for any one of us to make. May we so choose the civil thing. Amen. You go forth today to find your quiet center in the crowded life we lead. Find the room for hope to enter. Find the space where you are truly freed. Clear the chaos and the clutter. Clear your eyes that you may see all the things that really matter. May you be at peace and simply be. Amen. And have a great fortnight.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitarianessay@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching Essay Unitarians.